from WCVB Channel 5 podcasts and SportsCenter 5. It's Take 5 with Chris Gasper.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of the Take 5 podcast. Today's guest, the voice of the New England Patriots, Bob Soucy of 98.5 The Sports Hub. We talked to him about the Patriots' 1-1 start, and if we're being a little too hard on rookie quarterback Mac Jones. Is Mac Jones a system quarterback, or is there room for him to grow and eventually become a difference maker? Bob weighs in on that. Also, Bob, not a fan of comparisons between Mac Jones and Jared Goff. We also discussed the defense and how dominant they need to be for the Patriots to make the playoffs this year. And we delve a little bit into Bob's background as a play-by-play announcer. He had a connection with a Belichick, but not the one you think, going back to the Naval Academy. And Ellen, I know you like this. Bob, believe it or not, was once the play-by-play voice of a minor league baseball team that evokes The Simpsons.
So anyone who listens knows that I'm a very casual sports fan, but one thing that I do know are The Simpsons.
Yes.
I can't believe that that's a real team, the Isotopes.
The Albuquerque Isotopes, a real minor league baseball team that Bob Soucy was actually the original voice of.
So what he was saying is that this team was voted on by fans.
Yes.
Because Isotopes makes sense for The Simpsons with the power plant.
Yeah, with Mr. Burns and the power plant.
But
yeah.
These fans, just, these are my people, is what I got out of that conversation.
Yeah, it was really interesting. He said that the players nicknamed the field the lab, which was kind of interesting. But yeah, an actual team and a lot of Simpsons tie-ins there. So I thought that was kind of fascinating. You know, Bob's kind of a straightforward guy. His wonderful, wonderful voice. The timbre of his voice is great for play-by-play. But really, I thought we were able to sort of get behind the mic a little bit with Bob Soucy. And that was really enjoyable. I think you'll enjoy that. And certainly, he's very knowledgeable about the Patriots. You're going to want to hear his takes on the team. Those are coming up next.
Hey, Boston, let's talk sports. WCVB Sports Center 5, The Contact.
Source at MLB tells me.
Expert analysis.
That's going to be a major point of contention.
On air.
I talked to a high-ranking source.
And exclusive articles free on the WCVB app. Duke Castiglione, Chris Gasper, Bob Halloran, and special correspondent Mike
Once
Lynch.
Again,
the strongest team covering Boston's teams.
The only game in town.
WCVB Sports Center 5 on Boston's news leader.
All right, now, as promised, we're joined by the voice of the New England Patriots, Bob Soucy of 98.5, The Sports Hub. Bob, thanks for joining us here on the Take 5 podcast.
Well, Chris, thank you very much for having me. I like the inflection, though. I always consider Gil Santos as the voice of the Patriots. I'm just lucky enough to sit in the same booth that he occupied.
Oh, that's very classy. And you're one of the classiest in the biz. Yes, Gil, we love Gil, voice emeritus. We'll just say the current voice of the Patriots, Bob Soucy. Already, I think, pretty interesting season for them. I know we're only two games into the Mac Jones era, Bob. The Patriots are 1-1. They get their first win on Sunday against the New York Jets. And I want to start there because I thought that game was a little bit of a blueprint for how the Patriots can play and win this year. Strong defense that limits points and forces turnovers, a solid running game, 4.2 yards per rush, and safe, competent, capable quarterback play. Do you think this is kind of a blueprint for the Patriots and something that they can follow to success this year against teams that are maybe a little better than the Jets?
Yeah, Chris, I think it's a general formula. Don't make critical mistakes that beat yourself. You go back to the line that Belichick has uttered, more games are lost than won in the NFL. I think Chuck Knoll told his Pittsburgh Steelers when he took over there, before you have to learn how to win games, you have to learn how to not lose them. I think it's going to be an effective formula if they can carry it out and play defensively the way they did, force the kind of mistakes that they did from Zach Wilson, overcome some of the special teams gaffes, frankly, kick out of bounds, some very good starting field position for the Jets on early possessions, and have a quarterback who doesn't make mistakes, but at least moves the offense, in great part because of the running game, as you touched on. But will it be good enough to beat the better teams on their schedule, to beat teams that will have a more competent offense all around than the New York Jets, as physically talented as Zach Wilson is? I think they're going to have to evolve a lot more offensively to do that. I think it's interesting, as you said, these first two games, the varied reactions in the immediate aftermath. The Pats lose a game against Miami, and at least in the early hours after the final play, people were encouraged in optimism There was a lot of optimism about Mac Jones in the offense.
Yeah, lost a game, and found a quarterback.
Like as soon as the game ended against the Jets, it was completely a different take from a lot of the same folks.
Oh, really? So you felt there? I thought the Jets win was good. I mean, yes, you have to keep it in perspective.
I think it's a good win, absolutely.
But you feel like you normally have a pretty good finger on the pulse, you know, and you're normally sort of one of the voices of reason. Do you feel like people are being overly negative about this win over the Jets?
Well, I think that there has been certainly a higher degree of criticism or questioning about the offense in the last 24 hours or so. I think part of that is because of the ineptitude of the Jets. And also people wanted to see more and more shots to the end zone, more vertical elements in the passing game. To me, I think it is a good win. I think this team is developing on the proper course, all things considered. And the way I look at it, Chris, with the young quarterback in particular, it's better to have a base where maybe things are too conservative, whether it's his decision-making, whether it's the play calling, whether it's because of the pressure of the opposing defenses or the lack of protection from your offensive line that's leading you down that more cautious path. I'd rather have somebody who works from a base of that than someone who makes the kind of mistakes and is prone to bad habits like we saw, for example, from Zach Wilson of the Jets on Sunday. So I think they're developing things the right way. There's still a long, long way to go. This is only week three coming up of an 18-week, 17-game season. But just the general sense I got, again, you know, surfing the dial of sports talk radio, which is always a dangerous proposition.
Yeah, that's so dangerous.
For someone like me.
Yeah, we both know that, Bob. Yeah, we're both survivors of the Felger and Maz guest experience. Yeah.
Not to mention Adam Jones and Christian Arcand, yes, our beloved evening hosts.
Two of my faves, yes, yes. Yeah. No, it's interesting, though. And I wonder if that's, we're going to get into Mac Jones, but just Mac Jones has said something interesting several times to me this season, Bob. And he's talked about playing to the standard, right? And he's mentioned that phrase a couple of times. You know, Josh says we have to play to the standard. And so I want to extrapolate that, and maybe that's what's happening with fans and media. The standard here for the last two decades has been so high. And last year, obviously, it was 7-9. But we're not that far removed from, you know, a 12-win season in 2019 that people looked at as a disaster. So the standard is so high. I wonder if people are still doing what they used to do in the Brady era, which is that we used to have the luxury of grading victories and picking apart wins. And now it's sort of like we're finding out how the other half in the NFL lives, which is that a win is a win. And you just have to take it and be happy with it and move on. And I'm not saying we can't break down wins, but to break them down to the level we did when Brady was here and it was Brady and Belichick, I just think that's a luxury that we don't have anymore.
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. And I think it's something that we tend to do with the team in general, but particularly at that position. And maybe that's part of the excitement in week one was the reaction to Mac Jones' performance against the Dolphins based on, frankly, the ineptitude of the passing offense for much of 2020. And now that people expect a little bit more out of him, a closer to the standard performance, that we're going back and reverting to judging him by what Tom Brady did for so long. But you're right, 2019, by the middle of the season, people were judging Tom Brady and that offense against the standard that Tom Brady and the offense had set for so long.
So I think you and I have a little bit of a disagreement on Mac Jones. You know, again, I think that a lot of people have heard my comments on him, which I made before the draft, and I've sort of stuck with them. But I will be the first to say he's ahead of schedule and he's impressed me. He has exceeded my expectations. My situation with Mac Jones isn't so much about the floor. I think the floor is very high. It's capable, competent NFL starter that can take a team to the playoffs. My question is more on the ceiling. I'm not sure he'll ever be a difference-making quarterback. And so what I look at with Mac Jones so far, again, with the caveat that he's a rookie, I think he's something that Tom Brady never really was, but a lot of people labeled a system quarterback. I think that's a programmable passer, a guy that will, you know, follow the system, follow the plays, execute them, take what the defense gives you, but is not necessarily going to dictate to the defense. And this is, again, he's a rookie, more than two games in. It might be a little bit of an unfair standard, but I look at, say, you know, Aaron Rodgers last night, the touchdown throw he has to Robert Tonyan in the end zone. That's a tremendous throw. There's only a few quarterbacks, Brady, Rodgers, Breeze, Wilson, Deshaun Watson, maybe you can make that throw, Mahomes as well. I'm not saying Mac Jones has to make that throw, but I think the difference between in mentality between the elite quarterbacks and where Mac Jones is at, the Daltons, maybe even a Kirk Cousins, is those guys look at that and say, that guy's covered. He's not open. The elite quarterbacks look at that and say, I can throw him open. That's a touchdown. So I want to know where you stand on Mac Jones. And do you think that I'm, you know, being too harsh when I sort of say that I feel like the floor is Andy Dalton and the ceiling is Kirk Cousins?
Well, first of all, as you and I have discussed, the floor for Andy Dalton, at least if he is the floor, he made it to the playoffs his first 5 years with a team that was poorly coached and certainly had no discipline defensively, which ultimately costed a couple of those playoff games. So I think if you have a quarterback who makes it to the playoffs in his first 5 years, in most NFL cities, you would embrace that. You'd celebrate that. But of course, here in New England, that's not the case. You mentioned Rodgers and Brees. To my recollection, each of them won only one Super Bowl victory. So again, let's put Brady out of the conversation as often as people like to compare Mac to Tom. Now, I think when you look at Jones, I believe that some people sell him short in some areas, because I think, for example, when it comes to moving out of the pocket and making some throws, he's going to give you more of that than people expect. I go back to the first game. He hit Kendrick Bourne for a 33-yarder where he had to dodge around traffic in the pocket, roll out to his right, and throw down the right sideline. That play, unfortunately, was nullified. And I thought during camp and even a bit in the preseason, we saw that, in my opinion, he was going to give you more passes out of the pocket than a guy like Cam Newton, who's known as a running quarterback. Cam last year completed only 14 passes out of the pocket for the Patriots. That's just one aspect of his game that I think people sell him short on. But my feeling is that if he fulfills his potential and he reaches that ceiling, he's going to be a lot better off, and his team is going to be a lot better off than a lot of these other quarterbacks, like perhaps the one we saw on Sunday, and it's far too early to judge him, who have much higher ceilings, but really because of the circumstances around them and maybe, you know, some of the other variables, the intangibles that go into quarterback play, don't even approach their physical ceilings. I think so many guys don't reach their potential or even approach it because of things, in some cases, out of their control, coaching staffs, offensive philosophies, offensive lines, lack of receivers, whatever. And then there are a number of them who don't reach it because they just don't have the aptitude and the wherewithal to play to their potential. I think Mac Jones, as we've seen already, certainly, you know, is a very cerebral guy. And from that standpoint, he's advanced as a quarterback, very precocious at his age and his level of experience. I think that gives him a chance at least to maximize his talents. And maybe he gets the one Super Bowl victory to match Brees and Rodgers, but perhaps not the seven to match Brady.
Yeah, I mean, and you don't have to be an elite quarterback to win a Super Bowl. I mean, we've seen that with a guy like Joe Flacco, who, you know, I don't think was ever really elite, but he certainly played elite in 2012 when they were able to win that Super Bowl. So I think, you know, you're right on there. I just want to put it on the record, Bob Sosi predicting Mac Jones will win a Super Bowl. That's my takeaway. That's my takeaway from that entire answer. Bob Sosi on the Take 5 podcast predicting Mac Jones will win a Super Bowl in New England. That's a hot take from Bob. How do you feel about I know that in the past I've mentioned another name, a guy who I think actually played pretty well last night and has been to a Super Bowl, Jared Goff. If Mac Jones is Jared Goff, but being coached by Bill Belichick and Josh McDaniels, is that a win? Is that good enough? Or no, you don't like that comparison?
Well, the first thing is, and this is unfair to Jared Goff, I've never met him. I've been fairly close to him during the Super Bowl media week,
okay,
prior to Super Bowl 53. But I'll start with, I think Mac Jones has a pretty good idea of where the sun rises and where the sun sets.
Yes, that was a famous,
going back to
famous play, a famous interchange on Hard Knocks where, yes, Jared Goff had a little bit of difficulty with that. Yes, he did.
Yeah, and I also think, Chris, based on what we read and heard about the way Sean McVay had to coach Jared Goff right up until the final second that his microphone was open in his headset to communicate what the quarterback should have been seeing from his point of view in his headset, going against defenses, including in that Super Bowl, I don't think Josh McDaniels is going to have that same problem with Mac Jones, and probably doesn't already. We don't know that for sure, but certainly everything you hear from Patriots players and McDaniels himself and everything that Jones has displayed, whether at Alabama or the Patriots, suggest otherwise. So I think that's really where you start from. Does Goff maybe get knocked a little too often? He's an easy target. Yeah, he did get to a Super Bowl at a very young age. And he played through a lot of criticism, and he played pretty well last night, at least at the start of that game for Detroit. Despite, you know, despite number one being shoved out the door by the Rams, who went and made that trade and gave up so much to get Matt Stafford, and then, of course, exiled to Detroit with that horrible situation. That team is certainly in a rebuild. And I think Goff handles things pretty well overall on and off the field. But I do think Mac Jones, at least from the way I see it, has a higher ceiling than Jared Goff.
And I think there's some part of it, too, is like where you are playing. You know, I think Jared Goff, despite being booted from the Rams, was a really good fit for McVay and his system and was coached really well. And I thought it was really interesting, Bob, after week one, when the Patriots lost and Mac Jones played so well, 29-39, 281, that both Tua Tagovailoa, who played with him at Alabama, and Brian Flores, who was a coach here, was basically de facto defensive coordinator without the title. They both said that he was a good fit for the Patriots system. I thought that that was really interesting from those two guys to say that Mac Jones is a good fit for the Patriots system, because I know we talk about quarterbacks and nature versus nurture, but I do think there's an element here of Mac Jones having a lot of the attributes the Patriots really like, and this being a good fit for Mac Jones. Did you pick up on that as well? And what do you think of that? You know, when you have people familiar with the Patriots and familiar with Mac saying this is a good match for both sides.
Yeah, Chris, and it's not only Brian Flores, who had a chance to watch him during the Senior Bowl practices, albeit while with the other team a year ago when Jones was named the top quarterback on his team in the Senior Bowl. But it's people like Mike Tannenbaum, who worked for Bill Belichick, and he was on board immediately on the Jones train. Charlie Weiss was among his biggest advocates in the run-up to the draft. We had him on our Sunday show, Ted Johnson and I. I think about some of the other high-profile guys that were pounding the table for Mac Jones. Dan Orlovsky thought he would be a perfect fit for the Patriots. And I think there are several reasons why. When you look at his strengths and you look at what Belichick, or read what Belichick has said about what he looks for in a quarterback, decision-making and accuracy are right at the top of the list. Beyond that, too, I think adaptability when it comes to game plans varying from game to game. You have quarterbacks in the league who run systems. And I think that, to your point about Tom Brady earlier, it's very unfair to label Brady as a system quarterback by any stretch. We know that now, but even when he was labeled that 4 or 5 years ago, because the Patriots' offensive approach, while there are a lot of similar characteristics, they do tailor it to try to exploit the weaknesses of their opposing teams. And that means some days it's going to feature one back over another. Other days it's going to feature one tight end over another receiver, vice versa. And the quarterback has to be able to understand the concepts. Why are we doing this? Where am I going to go with the ball? What am I going to see from the defense? How do I execute it? And I think from that standpoint, again, based on, you know, Mac Jones's intelligence, I think he's a guy that should be well suited to doing what Josh McDaniels wants to do week in, week out, because whatever they put on his plate thus far, he's been able to grasp pretty well.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. I thought it was interesting listening to Josh McDaniels speak with the media on Tuesday, and he was asked sort of about the idea that maybe it's the play calling that's holding back Mac Jones from throwing the football downfield. In his first game, 29 of his passes traveled 10 yards or less. And in this most recent game, 22 of his 30 passes traveled 10 yards or less. So he's played it safe. You know, if Zach Wilson is defined by a four-letter word pick, I would say Mac Jones is defined by the four-letter word safe. But it was interesting to listen to Josh talk about whether having a rookie holds him back in terms of aggressiveness and play calling. He said, believe me, there's not a whole lot that we're holding back for him. And Mac Jones himself has said that basically the lack of downfield passing is on him. Where do you see that, Bob, at this point? Is it just that he's a young player and he's sort of, again, looking at it and saying, okay, the first thing I want to do is make sure I don't make a mistake, and that's what's going on? Or do you think he's being coached to just take what the defense gives you? And within that, I guess my other question to you is, what's the line between taking what the defense gives you, which is smart, but also letting the defense kind of dictate to you what's happening instead of the other way around?
Yeah, Josh today also said, I fully trust him. I have full trust and faith in Mac Jones. And maybe that's just something that he wants out there so that Mac Jones receives that, hears that, and buys into that the coach does have full faith in him and trust in him, despite what many might see as a conservative approach, especially early in the first game versus Miami. I think, Chris, again, it goes back to a variety of factors, and Josh touched on some of these too. Sometimes I think it's dependent fully on this game situation. Now, against the Jets, really in the second half, was pretty apparent if the Patriots don't make mistakes and give the Jets any silly opportunity to come back in this game, it's over. So maybe that dictates whether he takes a risk downfield with the ball or not. I think in some cases, you're probably right. Mac Jones might have seen something, but just that iota of indecision or uncertainty, or maybe also, you know, erring out of caution.
Yes.
He checked it down rather than throwing it deep. You know, that's probably a factor. It's probably been so ingrained in him. Don't throw the ball away. Don't throw the ball away. Because we didn't even see many interceptions going back to practices and training camp.
Good point.
And I think about when Jimmy was a rookie and in his second year, frankly, Josh McDaniels would encourage him to throw the ball and take some risks.
Test the limits.
Test the limits. Know what you can do so that you can understand it going into a game. And maybe Mac Jones is at that point where, you know, things have been so ingrained in him from day one, and even going back to Alabama, the way, you know, Nick Saban coaches, that he'd rather err on the side of caution. And now he started to understand, okay, I've got some shots that I can take that are available to me. And perhaps we'll see the offense evolve. I also think too, Chris, we have two new tight ends we're seeing on a week-to-week basis for the Patriots. Two new lead receivers, although you could argue that Jacoby Myers is their top receiver. But Aguilar and Bourne, of course, are going to be central parts of this offense going forward. Right now, a mess at right tackle without Trent Brown. A lot of pressure from two teams that apply to pressure in various ways the first two games. So to me, I think it's so early, and there are so many factors at play here with a young quarterback, again, in a 17-game rookie season over 18 weeks, but there's still a lot of room for growth, and I think we're going to see him evolve and see the offense evolve.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And just to be clear on it, look, I'm not one of those people asking for him to throw the ball 40 yards downfield, but I look at the Patriots' offense, and the best throws in that offense are the intermediate throws, you know, a 15-yard in-cut. And so when I look at 22 of the 30 throws being actually, you know, less than 10 yards the way NextGen defines it, I just think, to Mac Jones's point, he's leaving some meat on the bone there. And I think of this play, Bob. Third quarter, they're at the Jets 13, could deliver a knockout punch. It's 3rd and 9, and he throws a check down to James White for minus 1 yard. Now, it looked like on the back end he might have had Aguilar. I don't know. I'm not a quarterback. I'm not an offensive coordinator. On paper, that play goes down as a good play. It's a completion. It looks safe. But I look at it differently from the standpoint of, okay, you throw it to James White, who's super reliable, but he has no chance to get the first down. What if your throw gets tipped at the line of scrimmage because it's a short throw? What if James White fumbles? In that circumstance, I almost look at it and say you should throw it into the end zone and hope you get a pass interference that will pick it up, pick up the first down. Or if you really want to be safe, just chuck the thing into the first row of stands. And so I think that sometimes, you know, what looks like the right play on paper situationally is not the right play, in my opinion. And I think that's sort of an example of it. And what I want to see a little more from Mac Jones is some of the nuance of understanding that. And also long term, I look, there are some quarterbacks in this league, in my opinion, Bob, who they will always, and I think Cousins is like this, they will always take the completion.
Yes.
And at times, the right play is to actually take more of a chance to make a play for your team instead of taking the completion. I think there's a lot of quarterbacks, not all of them. We saw this with Zach Wilson, but a lot of quarterbacks who can just take what the defense gives them and consistently take the completion. But situationally, at times, just taking the completion isn't the right play.
Chris, I couldn't agree more. I think that's a very fair assessment. And I think that especially dependent upon the opponent that you're playing. Also, though, you have to have trust that your receivers can make plays. You have to give your receivers at times, particularly if a guy is considered your number one target, you've got to give him the opportunity to go make that play for you. And I'm not sure yet if that trust, that chemistry is developed between Mac Jones and those receivers, but I tend to think it's probably more on the quarterback than the receivers in that relationship. And I do wonder sometimes, when I go back to training camp and even in those joint practices, watch some of those long methodical drives. Remember the practice where Cam Newton started, took the first reps, but then Mac Jones took over a series and he wound up with, I think, twice as many reps or thereabouts as Cam Newton in that series. Was that an indicator of what we were going to see in the regular season with these long drives, 14 play drives, a lot of time off the clock, for example, against Miami. It bears watching if it continues, but it has led me to think of drives like that in training camp. And again, those longer, time-consuming, methodical drives. And when you get into regular season play and the defenses play the way they do, scheming things the way they do, the effort that you get, you're playing against the starters rather than backups or guys who aren't even going to be on the team. Well, the mantra, make them snap it again, is a great defensive philosophy, the bend but don't break philosophy. And the more times you have to snap it, the more prone you are to mistakes that set you back, including, a drop back and an intentional grounding call, or a drop back and a backward pass into the turf when you're being pressured. And I'm not trying to, criticize Mac too much on a couple of the plays in the first 2 weeks, but I do think that it certainly is something that they're going to have to address and get better when it goes to playing against much better teams. Another factor for me too is you look at Damian Harris and his success against the Jets. He ran against a lot of heavy fronts, a lot of eight-man fronts from the Jets, which we saw a lot of course, last year with Cam at quarterback. And sometimes you're going to have to make a defense pay. You're going to have to throw it with a purpose and make a defense pay and at least respect the deep ball and your willingness, as you say, situational, your willingness to take those shots downfield. And you're right. Sometimes, the one-yard completion to set up a second and nine, it's not worth it when you compare the risk and reward of taking that deep shot into the end zone for a guy who, if he doesn't make the catch, is likely going to draw a penalty.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think, I think that Mac will evolve, as you said. And what I think, Bob, is that people are comparing him to the wrong Patriots quarterback. I think we all agree. So unfair to compare him to Tom Brady. But you know what it reminds me of a little bit? Matt Castle in 2008. And when Matt Castle had obviously more game experience at that point than Mac Jones did as a rookie, Matt wasn't a rookie, but he hadn't started a game since high school. And when he first came out, his first two starts for the Patriots in the 08 season, 16 of 23 for 165 yards, no touchdowns, no interceptions. That was against the Giants in week two. Week three, they lost 38-13 to Miami. He was 19 of 31, 131 yards, one touchdown, one interception. That game, less famous for what Matt Castle did, more famous for what the Dolphins did on offense with the Wildcat. But do you know that by week 10 of the season, in week 11, he had back-to-back 400-yard, three-touchdown pass games? So I look at Matt Castle as the guy that Mac Jones should be compared to, not Tom Brady, in terms of that evolution. I think there's a path there. There's a blueprint there for Mac Jones and Josh McDaniels, who was the offensive coordinator in 2008 for Matt Castle, to follow.
Yeah, that's a really interesting observation. I wasn't here, of course, calling the games when Matt was the quarterback. That was my first year in the Boston area, in fact. I moved north after finishing a minor league baseball season. I hate to say, on opening day of 2008. And I went to pick up a pizza at a restaurant in Quincy, where I saw the play that ended the season for you-know-who.
Oh,
so
God, yeah.
I wasn't as invested at the time in the Patriots in 2008, but I've never heard that comparison made between Mac Jones and Matt Castle. I've heard some people, liken his situation for obvious reasons to Jimmy Garoppolo, and even compare him as a quarterback to Jimmy, who interestingly has a lower average yards per target average right now, I think, through the first 2 weeks of the season than Mac Jones at this point out in San Francisco. But there is a blueprint, Chris, and I think that, when you look at, Mac as the Patriots quarterback, he only needs to do what they need him to do.
Yes.
And that might be, in some situations, go out and win games, make the play on the last minute drive to win us the game against, a team that may be better in 2 weeks, maybe even this week against the Saints. Hard to tell what they are at this point because of the different circumstances, totally opposite circumstances for New Orleans in their first two games. But they have a good defense if they have all their defensive players available to them. He may have to make some plays these next 2 weeks that he hasn't even attempted to make the first 2 weeks. And down the road, he's going to have to make more of them if this team gets to where it ultimately wants to go. And that's the playoffs, let alone, deep in the playoffs.
And we've talked a lot about Mac and the offense, and we could talk about it all day. They've had some red zone struggles, 2 of 7. But I want to turn it over to the defense and give them their due. Forcing the 4 interceptions against Zach Wilson, only allowing 6 points, the way that they played. I know still some questions about the run defense based on the way the Jets were able to run the football in this game and average 4.9 yards per rush. But I want to ask you, since we talked about Mac Jones' ceiling, what do you think the ceiling is for this defense? Because there's so much talent in the front seven, and you see a little bit of what they can be last Sunday.
Yeah, Chris, I do think that there's a high ceiling for this defense. I thought in the preseason that they had the potential, assuming Stephon Gilmore was out there at cornerback, to be an elite defense, a top five defense in the league. And then when Gilmore was put on the pup, and after what we saw in some of the practices with Jalen Mills and Juwan Williams on the outside, playing perhaps out of position in the case of Mills, where he's better versatile inside. And in the case of Williams, you know, basing what we had seen his first couple of years in the league, the judgment on those two seasons, and then looking at him in a couple of practices, particularly joint practices in Philadelphia, I really questioned whether, you know, they were going to suffer a lot because of the absence of Stephon Gilmore. Now, I think that, you know, Mills, with the ankle injury against Devontae Parker on the outside, conceded a lot of ground. Williams the same against the Dolphins. Part of that was the concept. Maybe that was a reflection of not having Gilmore out there, playing softer coverages, doing a little more zone than Bill Belichick typically will do. It's a man coverage team, typically, especially as the season wears on. I think, though, at this point, that they still have the potential to be a very good defense, whether Gilmore does come back or whether he goes elsewhere or stays on the sideline for them by the middle of the year, because I think the front seven is going to get a lot better. I know the run fits right now aren't there. People are questioning the yards that they gain, but the pieces are there. You look at Godshaw, he's not played well in the first two games. But I look at a guy like Barmore, I think, man, this guy's a beast. He's going to get a lot better. Judon has been very effective for them. We didn't see Carl Anderson hardly at all in the first game. A little more presence in the last game. I just think that it's going to take some time for those guys to get together without Van Noy out there as well last week.
Good point.
That took away from some of the experience and communication to do more defensively. But at the same time, it gave Uche the opportunity to have an impact on the game, particularly in the second half that he did. So I just think that you're right. I think the defense has the potential to be a very good defense. You know, I did think before the season started, again, to recap and try to do it concisely, that they needed Gilmore to be elite top five. You know, maybe they can get through this season and still be a very, very good defense if Gilmore misses half the year or, you know, perhaps doesn't play at all.
You mentioned Josh Uche there. I want to ask you about him. What have you seen from him in terms of improvement? And I know, you know, you're around the team so much, so is Zoe. What have you heard about him and maybe what has contributed to his improvement? Seems like his role is a little different this year. Bill has said in the past there are some players better going forward and some players better going backwards. I thought last year they really had him going backwards a lot, sort of dropping as a linebacker. This year it looks like he's more of a pass rusher, and he leads him in sacks already with three.
Yeah, Chris, he's really a bright and engaging kid. It was interesting. We spent some time with him during a production meeting for a preseason telecast before the game in Philadelphia. And he said he tries to learn one thing every day from every guy that he's around. I asked him about the veteran presence on the team, Matt Judon, Dante Hightower, Kyle Van Noy. And he said, I try to take one thing away from each of those guys every day. And he showed that too, that attitude, that approach in the offseason. He was invited to the Von Miller Pass Rusher Summit, went to that. I think that maybe what Bill is doing is using him in a way that's more suitable to his skills and also comfort level, confidence level, based on what he did at Michigan too. Don Brown essentially used him at Michigan, as I understand it, as primarily a pass rusher, go wreak havoc. And that's what he excelled at. And I think you're right. I think last year they were trying to experiment, and also without a spring on the field, no OTAs on the field, without a training camp that was full training camp or regular preseason. I think the rookies last year had such a challenge, particularly at positions in the Patriots scheme where they ask you to do a lot more than even in other NFL defenses or offenses, but especially compared to college. So Uche playing on the edge, playing the linebacker for the Patriots, you know, his mission last year was to try to learn the whole defense as a rookie, very difficult task. And I think they eventually discovered what he's best at. And maybe we're seeing more of that this year, but also I think it's part of the commitment he's made in the classroom on his own in terms of making himself a lot better.
I want to ask you about Sunday's opponent, the New Orleans Saints, because I know for those of you out there who don't know, Bob does copious research. He's always prepared. I caught him on a Wednesday recently at Gillette, you know, putting together his board, as we were going later into the evening. So Bob always has a lot of good nuggets on the other team. What do you make of the Saints and Jameis Winston? Week one, they had probably the best win in the NFL against the Green Bay Packers, and Jameis Winston throws 5 touchdown passes. Week two, they lose to the Carolina Panthers. They get blown out 26-7. They only have 128 yards of total offense, and Jameis is 11 of 22 for 111 yards with 2 interceptions. What team are the Patriots facing on Sunday?
It's a great question. I tried to ask Rod Mayo that same question today, and I think he credited Sean Payton more than dissected the first two games. Of course, Payton is one of the better play callers in the league, and I think in this league where people like Sean McVay and Kyle Shanahan, with good reason, often get a lot of the attention and are the subjects of great discussion about their abilities to call plays and be offensive wizards. I think Sean Payton has done it for a long time. I go back to when he was calling plays for the Giants and Jim Fossil gave him those responsibilities. I think that the Saints are two different teams the first 2 weeks because they've had basically two different teams out there versus Green Bay and Carolina. They had to play against the Panthers, first of all, without 8 members of their staff, a number of coaches, including, interestingly, their offensive line coach, were unavailable for that game and really for the better part of that week to be there present physically for preparation. Now, Sean Payton downplayed that and said no excuses when it comes to, you know, the coaching situation for the game against the Carolina Panthers, who I do think, too, have a very good defense.
I would agree.
And have a kind of a college-style defense, as has been described by Drew Brees, in fact, a different look than a lot of college teams see, a lot of pro teams see, and especially they're very good up front. But I think that in the case of the Saints, they had changes on their offensive line. They lost their center in week one, Eric McCoy, who was injured on the first series. They had to move some people around, including Cesar Ruiz, who's a good guard for them, player they drafted out of Michigan a couple of years ago. They had issues with communication up front. All the players talked about it. Winston talked about it after the game, diagnosing and then adjusting to the zone pressures from Carolina. So I think that was a factor. No Michael Thomas again, no Traquan Smith again for them at wide receiver in that game. They couldn't run it. Alvin Kamara, I think, had 8 carries for 5 yards.
That is correct.
His longest run was for 5 against Carolina in that game. And so that forced Jameis Winston to be a different kind of player than he was the first week, where it was a very efficient performance. 148 yards, the fewest yards thrown in a 5-touchdown performance in NFL history. And one of those TD passes was 55 yards to Deontay Harris. So Sean Payton had gotten in the game against the Packers to do everything that he didn't do against Green Bay, or at least to avoid the things he did while with Tampa Bay. And that's, you know, don't put the ball in harm's way, be efficient, take what's there, and be willing to live another down after the 30-touchdown, 30-interception season for him with the Buccaneers in 2019. Well, last week they got behind. They couldn't run the ball. They couldn't keep the Panthers' offense off the field as well. They just couldn't generate any offense. They didn't score until late in the game. They were at risk of suffering their first shutout, I think, since Aaron Brooks was their quarterback under Jim Haslett. So it was just a total anemic performance by the Saints in that game. But I do think in large part it was because of the circumstances that they faced without the coaches that normally would be there. If your offensive line coach is on the sideline, are you better at making adjustments to the pressures you're seeing from the other team? And, you know, and does that help the quarterback set the protections? You got a different center in there than week one. Beyond that, I think as well, the inability to run the ball against the Panthers just put too much on Winston's plate.
Yeah, Winston, an interesting guy, sort of a reclamation project for the Saints, his second year in that organization, his last year in Tampa before they got some guy named Tom Brady to take over last year. He was part of the 30-30 club, and not in a good way. He threw 33 touchdowns but 30 interceptions to lead the NFL. So I think you've seen these first 2 weeks sort of what Jameis Winston can be. It's feast or famine. And I think there's a fascinating comparison here, I think, between the Patriots and the Saints in terms of how they're treating life after a franchise quarterback, after somebody who defined their organization and who automatically gave them a chance to win by stepping on the field. Obviously, that's Tom Brady for the Patriots. The Patriots now 2 years removed. This is the first year that Sean Payton is playing without Drew Brees at all, although there were injury issues last year and Taysom Hill had to step in and Winston had to play a little bit. But I do find that sort of fascinating, that juxtaposition there between the two sides and how they're going about replacing their legendary quarterbacks. The Patriots at this point all in with the first round pick and Mac Jones, and Sean Payton trying to take a reclamation project guy, a guy who was a very high draft pick in the NFL and first overall in 2015, and see if he can get him to be what he hasn't been so far. I find that fascinating.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting too. And the Payton essentially did the same thing with Teddy Bridgewater. You recall when he was let go after his first pro stint with Minnesota, Sean Payton signed him as a backup, and I think saw him as an insurance policy, one who could be developed. And eventually, Teddy signed elsewhere, left New Orleans, and went elsewhere. And last year, Jameis Winston was in the same situation. He really had nowhere to go, or maybe very limited choices. So he signed a one-year deal for a little over $1 million, bided his time, learned, and occasionally spelled Drew Brees late in the San Francisco game. And he had a good game in that contest, came out for a trick play against the Buccaneers in the playoffs and threw a long touchdown pass in that game, and showed enough to Payton and the Saints that they signed him back for 1 year at $12 million. And yet there was speculation that Payton was very interested in Mac Jones prior to the draft. But it is a different approach. They signed Taysom Hill to this huge contract, which is really a contract with a lot of funny money in it. And he gives them another option. So Payton, I think it seems like Payton is kind of trying to patchwork this season at quarterback between Winston, try to draw the best of Winston and avoid the worst out of him. And then with Hill, use him situationally to maximize, you know, the production for your offense with those two guys at quarterback. And in 2022, they're probably going to have to go out and get another quarterback, I would have to think. If Winston has a great year, maybe they're able to re-sign him, but they were up against the cap. They had all kinds of salary cap issues this year, so they didn't really have a lot of flexibility either to go out and make a splash in free agency. It is an interesting situation. And it points out too, Chris, because of the salary cap issues, they have 10 new starters on this team. So it is a very different team in a lot of ways. And they've had a number of them, number of players injured on defense too, without Drew Brees on offense, but also, you know, without some of the guys that, you know, they've been counting on, have been very good for them. Like Marshawn Lattimore didn't play last week. He's probably coming back for this game. A word is out in New Orleans. Quan Alexander for them, a linebacker, got off to a good start in the Green Bay game, was out last week. And again, several others missing from action from the Saints. But it is interesting, as you noted, the contrast between the approach that Payton took and the one that Belichick took. I kind of think what Bill did last year with Cam Newton inside at the last minute is somewhat the way Payton is trying to manage this season for the Saints.
Yeah, that's a good point. And of course, what's interesting is that Drew Brees was a reclamation project of sorts for the Saints when he came there, not because of performance, but he was coming off a devastating shoulder injury. Not a lot of teams thought he really had anything left, and he turned out to have the best years of his career in New Orleans with Sean Payton. I want to wrap it up here, Bob, with something that's not football, but just sort of about you. I think a lot of people know that you were the voice of Navy football from 1997 to 2012. And I am curious if during that time you had any interaction with Bill Belichick, who obviously grew up in Annapolis, his father, legendary scout coach for the Naval Academy. So I was curious how much Bill was around that Navy program and if you got to know him in that job.
Chris, the only interaction I ever had with Bill Belichick was after his father's passing, when Bill returned to the Naval Academy to donate their football library to the Navy football staff in the football office. There is a beautiful library now in the lobby of the Navy football office on the Academy Yard in Annapolis, filled with books from Bill and Steve Belichick that they had collected through the years when they would go on Steve's scouting trips. Bill would accompany him and they would stop at yard sales, at used bookstores, wherever, to find these old football books. And it was one of the largest collections of football books at the time in the world. I think it might've been the second or third largest collection of football books in the world when Bill donated it to the Naval Academy, I believe in 2006. Now, I had a lot of interaction with his dad. Steve Belichick was a fixture at the Naval Academy in retirement. He'd been on the coaching staff, the scouting staff, for 33 years at the Naval Academy, as well as a physical education instructor. So when he retired from coaching and teaching, he returned to the academy almost on a daily basis and used the phys ed facilities to work out. And then he would come into the football and athletic department offices and read the newspapers and get a cup of coffee. And he would first bring, at the time, Bill was either with the Jets or the Patriots when I was there. He would bring the New York tabloids or the Boston Globe, whatever newspaper he had with Patriots news. And he would bring those publications into the athletic department. He would drop them off for somebody who might have been interested. There was a Jets fan, who, for example, worked in the sports information office. And then he would go into this room where they had all the local newspapers delivered daily, the Baltimore Sun, the Washington Post, the Annapolis Capital. And Steve would sit down at a table there and read all those newspapers voraciously with his styrofoam cup of coffee that he got down the hall at the Navy football office. Well, that was also a waiting area for reporters and the team's play-by-play announcer while waiting for an interview. So I would sit down at that table sometimes and pick Steve's brain or just listen to him tell stories. And over the course of time, got to know him pretty well, not very well, but pretty well. And he was always very nice to me. But my favorite Steve Belichick story that I tell is about a broadcast that I did early in my tenure between Navy and Rutgers. And Rutgers was coached by a former assistant to Bill Walsh named Terry Shea. And Terry Shea had Rutgers adopt the San Francisco 49ers uniforms. He had the West Coast offense installed and was trying to recreate the West Coast on the East Coast in Piscataway, New Jersey. And so at one point during a broadcast between Terry Shea's Scarlet Knights and the Midshipmen, I said that Terry Shea learned from the father of the West Coast offense. A couple of days later, I'm walking down the hall of Ricketts Hall, the athletic department offices, and I hear this voice in the background. Hey, I want to talk to you about something you said on the radio the other day. And I turned around and it was Steve Belichick. He said, you said Bill Walsh was the father of the West Coast offense. Well, I want to tell you about the West Coast offense. And for like the next 30 minutes, I got a lesson on Paul Brown and the real origins and evolution of the West Coast offense. And, he was revered at the Academy. I remember talking to Phil McConkie, who went on to play in the NFL, of course, years after his retirement. And he said, even years after graduating from the Naval Academy, he still woke up every day. One of the first people he thought of was Steve Belichick, because he would start his day in his older age doing the stretching routine that Steve Belichick taught him as a young midshipman. And you'd hear admirals and captains, people who had been around the academy, who'd gone to the academy and graduated from there, gone out to serve in the fleet or the Marine Corps, and then come back to Annapolis either to teach or in retirement. And if they were there in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, they always talked about what an influence Steve Belichick had on their lives.
Wow, that is a great story, Bob. I really enjoyed that. I got to ask you one more here before we go, which is you work for the Albuquerque Isotopes. A lot of people might not know that you were a minor league baseball play-by-play guy. Oh, there. Yes, you're showing us. You're Albuquerque Isotopes. So I'm just curious.
Wait. I need to jump in for just one second.
Yeah, Ellen.
Isn't that the team on The Simpsons?
That's what I was just going to ask him. Yes, that's the team on The Simpsons. Go ahead, Ellen. You ask it.
No, that's all I got. That's my sports reference for today.
Very good.
That's a real team? That's my question.
Yes, no, it's a real team. And so I wanted to know, Bob, if you've ever seen that episode of The Simpsons and how much the Topes, as they call them in The Simpsons, play up sort of that Simpsons illusion.
Yeah, Chris. Well, I started with the Albuquerque Isotopes in their very first year. Their inaugural season. They didn't move from Springfield, but instead moved from Calgary, Alberta.
Okay.
An owner of several minor league baseball teams bought the team in Calgary, and Albuquerque had previously lost the old Albuquerque Dukes, who were a Pacific Coast League dynasty in the Dodger days. They had moved out of Albuquerque. So the team in Calgary was bought and moved to Albuquerque. They basically built a new stadium in the footprint of the old stadium, and through a name the team contest, whether it was rigged or not, they came up with the nickname Isotopes. So, yes, I was the first voice of the Albuquerque Isotopes outside of the fictional announcer on The Simpsons. And that episode of The Simpsons, by the way, might have been written by a gentleman who was a very good situational comedy writer in television for years, a guy by the name of Ken Levine, who I know wrote my friend Dan Horde into an episode for The Simpsons as a sports announcer. Dan is the voice of the Cincinnati Bengals. Ken Levine was a longtime baseball announcer in the minor leagues. and briefly in the major leagues, I think, with the Orioles and the Angels. And Ken Levine, I'd have to think, penned the episode with the Albuquerque Isotopes. Of course, of being the team or the Springfield Isotopes moving to Albuquerque. But yeah, the team was the Topes, and the player's nickname, the stadium, the lab. And then they gave the fans a nickname as well to go with the lab. But I'm not going to repeat that.
All right. I think that's a high point there. That's a good point to end it. Bob, thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate it. I've always admired the fact that as a play-by-play announcer, you basically cover the team like a beat person. And I think that really contributes to your knowledge and your success on Sundays. So I just want to point that out for those who listen. You know, Bob, all those nuggets Bob comes up with, that's Bob and that's his work. No one's feeding that to him. So enjoy Bob Soucy, the current voice of the New England Patriots. You can listen to him on 98.5 The Sports Up. Bob, thanks for joining us here on the Take 5 Pod.
Chris, that's far too kind. I'm happy to join you anytime with flattery like that, but I really appreciate it. And I don't do anything more than any other guy in the league does. And certainly the beat reporters and people like yourself know a lot more, have forgotten a lot more than I know about the Patriots and this football team.
Yeah, Bob, with flattery like that, you can also come back anytime. That is the one and only Bob Soucy. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Take 5 Podcast. We appreciate it as always. Don't forget to subscribe and rate the podcast so others can find it and enjoy it. And now you can email us at take5@wcvb.com. We'd love to get your feedback and hear your thoughts. We'll catch you next time.